Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Brock. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. You and I are both looking at each other in the video, and we look like we have been, with our full beards, we look like we've been hiding in a cave for 12 months. And I guess that's sort of what a lot of us have been doing. But you and I are going to be in Ottawa, virtually speaking together for the AFP conference up there here in about 5 or 6 weeks. And so we decided to get together, you and I, to familiarize ourselves with each other and banter around some big ideas. But before we do that, Brock, how about we just ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Thanks for having me. My name is Brock. I'm based up here in Toronto. I've been fundraising for about 12, 13 years. And over that time, I've developed quite a bit of interest and expertise in digital fundraising. This past year, started my own business, which kicked off with the release of a book called From the Ground Up, Digital Fundraising for Nonprofits. Based that on the last 5 years of being a part-time professor at Humber College in one of the leading fundraising programs. And ever since then, I've been helping nonprofits to level up and upskill their digital programs and try to hone those strategies because it's needed now more than ever before.
Okay, Brock, so I'm going to put you on the spot here. Are you a pro or anti-charity water guy? Because if you're a digital guy, you probably got to be somewhat okay with what they're doing, right?
You have to look at them for some inspiration.
Yeah, they're just fascinating, right?
Yeah, you got to take a look at them. And you know, something I recall that hearing about what they did years ago is they made investments in their web development teams. They hired coders instead of hiring developers. And that felt like a big bet 7-8 years ago when I heard that. But nowadays, when you hear about how Domino's is a technology company that happens to sell pizza and Amazon is a technology company that happens to sell you groceries and books, they were onto something. Love them or hate them, they're onto something.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, totally. I won't totally put you too much on the spot, but at least you gave him a slight nod. I don't tolerate some of the wizards that keep picking on charity water. I'm like, maybe some of the problem is that they've just completely abandoned direct mail, like all of the rest of us are completely indoctrinated and stuck on, and they're actually raising a hell of a lot of money in the process. And so I have to imagine a digital guy like you has got to sort of see, at least see some value in the exploratory experimenting sort of zone.
I'll give you one quick example of how something they must have been experimenting with recently that I would love. I'd love to sit down with someone, find out the scoop on this is I watch YouTube quite a bit because I've got two little kids, so I don't get a ton of time to like watch movies or binge shows on end. But so I got 10-minute YouTube content is great for me. And I started for a solid month getting advertised in the little pre-roll ads, a like 27-minute Charity Water documentary, like the story of Scott Harrison.
Totally.
And that has been knocking around in my head, wondering what might they know that we don't know about long form content.
Yeah.
So not 6-second strong call to action, not even like a 1-minute teaser of something else. It's let's give them the whole shebang and let's pay for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're a college professor. I'm a part-time college professor as well. And I've got these 20, you know, there's 20 or 30 students in my class every semester. And I've got sort of this, you know, short list of half a dozen videos that I show them. And every time I show these 18 to 22 year olds, the Scott Harrison, probably the same video you're referring to, they're all familiar with it. It's like they've already seen this. You know, they've already spent 25 minutes watching Scott Harrison's YouTube video, and it's a very compelling piece. And it's just the first piece in a long line of amazing things that their company has done. And I just have to imagine that the fact that at the core of it, every critique that I read on Scott and what they've done at Charity Water seems to originate somewhere at the core with this idea that they've completely unplugged direct mail and said, we're not going to do it. And so I have to imagine a guy like you, Scott, you're going to be talking about digital fundraising, which is not direct mail. So we won't keep that thread of conversation going. You're going to be talking about digital fundraising in Ottawa. I know you've got a book out there. I have not read it. I'll happy to pick it up and you can tell me about it, but tell us what you're going to be talking about.
Sure. So it's an extension of the book. You know, the book is a culmination of the 5 years so far and, you know, knock on wood, many more to come of teaching at Humber, which is a fundamentals. What's your basic house you've got to get in order to be able to raise money online? So it's the basics. This is meant for someone who is starting from scratch. What I'm going to be talking about in Ottawa is kind of one level up from that. We're going to talk about, you know, how do we build on top of that foundation? You know, how might you take a more critical eye to understanding the purpose of social media within a larger fundraising program? How can you maybe better understand what is the donor value proposition and how does it come to life online?
Yeah.
Because while you might have one anchoring value proposition as a charity, it's going to have to manifest itself in one way in direct mail, another way on your website, another way in social media, albeit all coming back to the same core message and the same ask at the end of the day. And then I'm going to try and make sure that I end it all off with a list of free tools. I have worked in the nonprofit front lines, so to say, for nearly a decade. And I understand how pinched everyone is when it comes to those tools, those tips, those tricks. It can feel like you've exhausted all of your options for creating new ads or testing new copy, but trust me, there's new stuff being launched out there all the time, and most of it's free or cheap. So I'm going to make sure that I leave everyone with some helpful practical tools.
Yeah, Brock. So, you know, guys like me and you probably pay a lot of attention to, probably more than Scott Harrison, we're paying a lot of attention to our friend in New York City. Oh gosh, now I can't even think of his name. Gary Vaynerchuk. And he's the same type of guy who's always getting on his podcast, and he's basically reminding people, and this gives me something else. It gives us something that had not occurred to me, but he's always reminding people that a lot of the digital stuff out there is basically free, like you just said. And I kind of wonder if that's some of the unsettlingness in some of our expert circles, that as fundraising becomes more and more digital, if you're not actually doing it and using what are practically free tools, and like what Gary would be talking about, you can pretty much self-teach yourself. You know, Is digital fundraising essentially sort of that driver that is doing what I'm constantly talking about, in that it's constantly, it's redefining what fundraising, what the definition of fundraising expertise really is, because it's practically free in terms of the tools, and it's practically self-taught, which is what Gary's constantly getting at. Go out on the web, experiment with something, see if it works, and try something else next week. Isn't that really what it comes down to?
Absolutely. Yeah. What first comes to mind is the program that I teach in at Humber. I was a student in that program a very long time ago. And there was nothing digital. There was not a digital class. I think we kind of touched on it at the very end. So my first job was in direct mail. We don't need to talk direct mail, but trust me, I could.
Yeah.
I could talk about mailing specs and list trades. But I had to self-teach. And the agency that I was at the time, they were very supportive of this because they saw the business opportunity. So I had no shortage of opportunities to learn. But if I wasn't self-motivated to go and learn it, then we'd be in trouble. And as I teach the course every year, unfortunately, I can't dive. There aren't enough hours in the day to dive down deep into how exactly does Google Analytics work and how do you use it? And how exactly does the ad platform work and how to use it? Each of these are dozens of hours alone. But what I tell the students all along the way is Google, you have free resources out there. Google Analytics Academy, Facebook has blueprint programs. Every one of these ad platforms, they want you to be very good at it. It's in their business interest for you to be a very savvy marketer, because it means you're going to spend more. You're going to be able to demonstrate a better ROI up to whomever might be holding the purse strings. So I don't need to, these students shouldn't be paying tuition that pays my salary and my fee for something that they can get for free. That's not always a really satisfactory answer for somebody who wants to do it. So I spend more of my time talking about purpose and strategy and positioning and value propositions. And I want to touch on your point too about the constantly evolving digital fundraising, social media. It's a little bit like, you know, do you know the ship of Theseus, that thought experiment, that if something is built one, rebuilt one piece at a time, is it the same thing at the end?
The
ship leaves the harbor and it's replaced one board at a time. The ecosystem of digital fundraising tools is a lot like that. So if you haven't been paying attention, if you've been riding that ship for 7, 8, 10 years, and you haven't been paying attention to what other donation processors are out there, what other like SEO optimization tools are out there, what other like AI recommendations, like AI engines that you could use to optimize your content. If you haven't been paying attention, chances are the ship has been rebuilt under you and you don't even realize it.
Well, it's like this. So John Hagel, you probably know the guy's name. He's from the Silicon Valley. And John, a lot of what John talks about, and his colleagues at a consulting firm talk about, and this guy's talking about sort of the macro, you know, and largely the marketplace. It's not talking about fundraising by any stretch of the imagination. But what he's basically talking about is this transition that has been long happening in our economy. And it's the transition between scalable efficiency and to scalable learning. It's the idea that, sorry, folks, scalable efficiency was an early 20th century idea that started in the, you know, in the Ford Motor Company or something. And scalable efficiency really isn't necessarily going to give you the competitive edge. What's going to give you the competitive edge is what he calls scalable learning. And I think there's a component to that, both in what you're talking about, but also when we actually start getting in front of the donor, when we actually start having face-to-face interaction with the donor, whether it's on this platform or in person, rather than sort of constantly trying to exploit what we know. What John is saying is we've got to constantly sort of explore what we don't know. And that's exactly what you're talking about in the digital space. And that's usually what I'm talking about in the major gift space is we just need, I'm getting up on John's stuff here, but he talks about we have to have the passion of the explorer. And if you don't know how to sort of explore these spaces and learn new things, and you're just trying to exploit what was working 10 years ago, good luck.
With you. I'm with you. I consider myself a lifelong learner, and I feel like if it's not a prerequisite right now in job interviews and candidate screening, it has to be. You know, I live for that feeling of my brain expanding a little bit, as challenging as it can be to find those. But when they come, it's a high. It's a bit like, I imagine it's a little bit like when you're, if you ever tried to blow up an animal balloon, twisty animal balloon, and you're like busting your lungs trying to get that thing started, and then all of a sudden it shoots out 3 feet in the other direction. You know, every once in a while I'm picking up a book and that happens. And it often doesn't happen when I'm trying to learn about fundraising or digital fundraising. It happens when I've ventured off into some other like architecture because someone recommended a podcast. 99% Invisible has been a staple in my podcast library for years, and it's all about just hidden design, that 99% of design is unseen. And there shouldn't be any direct application to fundraising there, but holy mackerel, I can't help listen to that sometimes and think, I know exactly how I'm going to apply this in this fundraising program.
Wow, man, you're really making me fall in love with the idea of inviting more tech types onto the podcast, because I'm always nervous that they're going to want to get on and talk on my podcast about more technology. But what you're getting at is the interdisciplinary nature of pretty much the way our whole world is becoming. And again, I think that's kind of where fundraising finds itself stuck right now, is having originated, and perhaps rightfully so, and that's okay, but having originated in PR, marketing, and advertising sort of places, now we're starting to find that all those places are trying to, in some ways, sort of deal with their own sort of crisis in the world. Mm-hmm. We can't be, you know, Don Draper anymore. And what we really need to be thinking about is more interdisciplinary. When I was in education, so before my last job as a development officer and as a executive director, I worked for a private school, and these private schools in the inner city were working with low income kids. And we provided them with what they called a classical education. And classical education is the idea that you teach these kids how to learn. You don't teach them stuff. You don't actually put any single sort of tool in their hand and make them sort of master the tool. What you do is you teach them how to learn any tool that happens to be put in their hand. What it ultimately amounts to, Brock, is basically this interdisciplinary sort of appreciation of the world. And you're constantly grabbing it, like what, you know, Greek mythology, for example, and saying, okay, what sort of insight does this, you know, provide me? Sometimes I kind of wonder, sometimes in our space, I kind of wonder if we can't even seem to get out of our PR, marketing, and advertising box.
Yeah. I'll give you an example of this in practice. And I mean, I wish I could replicate it, but I can't. You'll learn why in a second. It's the genesis of Giving Tuesday. It's, I think we're all familiar with it, love it or hate it, activate on it or not, but we're all pretty aware of it now, almost on a global level. Henry Timms, I always get this mixed up. I think it's the Kennedy Center of the Arts, the Lincoln Center, one of the two.
Yeah, I think he was at the Y when he started it. He was at the Y when he started giving. I think he is at one of the Lincoln Center or something now. Yeah.
Yeah, and he told me that, or he told a group of us at a talk, and then I verified it through DM with him on Twitter, that the first conversation about shaping what Giving Tuesday might be, before it was even called that, around that table, he had Lady Gaga's manager. He had Robert Reich, I think he's a Princeton professor right now. I believe he was maybe also a labor secretary for a few administrations ago, but like a very, very progressive thinker, and like people from like the U.S. Aid and Development, I believe. So he had this very diverse group, and he summed it up for me. So credit to him is that just diverse inputs creates a stronger product.
It does. Absolutely.
And that had he assembled his fundraising team around the table, they probably wouldn't have come up with Giving Tuesday as a global movement, because, you know, how do you activate on it? What's the call to action? Oh, it's not just about fundraising? I don't think so. But you get these other people there, and there's something you can build a movement around.
I think what I appreciated when I read Tim's book and his co-author, Hymans, I think is his
Jeremy last name. Jeremy Hymans.
Yeah. When I read this book,
But what I think I most appreciated in that storyline, and maybe Tim's, maybe you heard this too when you heard him speak. And it's interesting you point out that he's been very, he's very generous on the social media feeds, because there was a reference that I made to Tim's in a speaking engagement, and somebody checked me on it and actually tweeted him, and he got back really quickly and said, "Yep, that's the story." Verified the story for me. Nice. While I was in the room, as if I wasn't up to par on my understanding of the story. But anyway, what Tim talks about in his book, again, which just gets back to this notion of expertise, which I'm totally trying to pick on lately, and forgive me, but Tim talks about this idea of how our world is moving to a more of a what you might call a growth orientation from a control orientation. And we have historically, everything's been built around these closed systems and these notions of control. And so what he talks about in as it relates to Giving Tuesday is they, you know, subsequent to the story that you're talking about, they came up with this great idea. It looked like it was going to really work, and people all around the world started using it. But as soon as they started using it, that impulse to try to control it and, you know, put out cease and desist letters and tell them you can't hijack our idea sort of thing came up. And what Tim says is it wasn't about control. We didn't want to control this thing. And so even though somebody was taking our idea, and in fact, he talks about the idea that in other parts of the world, they actually, you know, they kind of massaged the idea a little bit. They extended it to more days. They rearranged the words, but the underlying sort of concept was still pretty much Giving Tuesday. But he said, you know, we're about growing something. We're not about controlling something. And I think that's part of what, you know, when you and I talk about digital fundraising, when we talk about the reasons why some of us hop on these podcasts and basically give insights away, and you talk about these free tools that are out there just for the taking, I think we've just become more of a, we're not in the control game anymore. Am I right?
Yeah. Humans, I couldn't tell you why, not a sociologist or a psychologist, but humans seem to have an inclination to want to build castles.
Yeah.
Which is one of the categories in Tim's and Haven's book. We want to build castles, like a closed system
that
people can enter and we can push people out of. But the reality today is we live in an API economy. That you may have a core expertise, but you can and should draw on the expertise of others. I heard a stat that the average good app that we use on our phones probably draws in about 17 on average, 17 APIs. So the SMS function, the reminder function, the calendarizing function, you know, these are all different functions that are being pulled in from elsewhere. They haven't lost sight of the fact that they've got some core value that they're offering to the customer that no one else does, but they don't try to build the whole thing from scratch. And how I might abstract that to charities and how it could be practical to charities is you don't have to anymore purchase, say, like an all-in-one solution, like an all-in-one database that does absolutely everything for you. It processes your donations. It sends out your emails. It tracks your grant prospects. It calculates risk and probability. It identifies like all of that. You don't have to do that. You can, and there could be a strong case for maybe efficiencies internally for that. But if you want to optimize your program, taking a more modular approach, like, all right, let's because this is a fairly flexible modular system that we've built, then let's try out this AI prospect scoring tool for 6 months. Let's give it a try. And if we don't like it, you can unplug it. No harm, no foul. Yeah, maybe you pay it a little bit to get it set up, but you unplug it. And then, you know, maybe you want to try this new social ad management strategy, this new tool that's going to help you find your next $1 million donor on Facebook. And then 3 months later you find out it's not working, then you unplug it. You don't have to put all your eggs in those baskets.
Okay, go back all the way to where Brock, I might have to plug you into my now final edit version of my book. Is that essentially what the problem is that maybe we need to reconcile with our friends over at Charity Water, that if we're going to criticize them, it ought to be in the context of what they're not willing to sort of freely share, rather than necessarily because their particular approach to something isn't necessarily jiving with the way that we would do something? Like, shouldn't we expect of Charity Water, if you're doing all these amazing things,
perhaps, and I don't know that they don't, maybe they do in remarkable ways, but it would seem to me like what you're saying to me, Brock, is that if Charity Water's got a particular handle on this API, that by allowing other people to experiment with it and therefore learn actually becomes the standard by which we would describe an organization as doing well and sort of fitting into the sort of the timeliness of our world, rather than necessarily critiquing them on some philosophical decision about how they manage their checking accounts or something. Do you follow what I'm saying? It's more sort of how do we posture ourselves in the world, and less about sort of right and wrong, good or bad sort of notions.
Yeah, I think I'm following. They've built a bit of a castle in that. I don't know what they're
okay. Right. Doing. So that maybe ought to, yeah. Okay. So if you're saying they've built a castle, and I'm going to let you unpack this, but if you're saying they've built a castle, that ought to perhaps be a closed system, essentially. If they've built a closed system, perhaps that's what we ought to be criticizing them on, not necessarily the 100% approach or whatever the hell they call it.
Right. Right. It could be, you know, they could have systems in place for sharing what they've learned to the sector so that we can all grow together, perhaps.
Yes.
And, you know, fact check someone, hopefully, if not you, then somebody later fact check me if they do in fact have some sort of like open library of learnings. But I look to companies like NextAfter, who just their resource library of their findings, M&R benchmarks reports. There are organizations out there who do very good work on the consulting side and then are also very generous on the learning sharing side. And so Charity Water, they could share in a report to the sector of what has worked, the fundraising sector is what I'm referring to there. The sharing of what have they learned and why is it a good opportunity. I mean, if it's ethical and on the up and up, then I'd prefer to assume that it is.
Yes.
Then why not share with everyone? The only times I've interacted with Charity Water at, say, a conference have been when somebody parachutes in for a keynote and away they go.
Yeah. And they do celebrate they're very proud of their transparency on the way that they sort of interact with the broader, with their constituents, with their donors. But as it relates to the way that they, you know, relate to the rest of the fundraising community, that if any organization, sorry for hijacking this conversation with Charity Water, you certainly didn't expect this, but if any organization, like you're telling your students in your classroom, Brock, if any organization takes more of a sharing, generous, transparent, how can we sort of build a bigger pie rather than get a better slice, you know, bigger slice of the existing pie, is essentially what you're getting at. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've always taken a stance of let's share and let's learn together. Hasn't failed me yet, honestly. It's it only begets more generosity, has been my experience. For sure, you know, asterisk on all of that is, you know, don't share you've got private IP and you've got certain things that your charity may not want to share if you feel that it's proprietary. But if it's not proprietary, if you simply learned something about, you know, how the Google Ads grant program may have recently changed and the way in which you've pivoted to maximize your spend, let's share that so that we can all share in it, because the pie is not going to get any smaller.
Yeah.
To take the Google example.
Yeah.
Google's going to keep sharing those in-kind resources. I don't think that they're going to cap the program. They may change the criteria of the program around the spend, not to get too technical, but because they've done that several times over the years, but it's you'd be planting a seed. If you were to do that, if any organization were to be more forthcoming or try and set a new standard for what sharing of results and impact would be, it's a bit like planting an apple tree. You know, you plant that apple tree and then these the fruit, it will bear fruit, but also every fruit then has 5 more seeds. And the exponential growth potential of that across the sector means everyone's going to eat. Everyone's going to do good work. And I have to believe that the donors, if the ways in which we're speaking to them become more personal, more authentic, more transparent, all these things that we know make for great donor communications, if more people and more organizations adopt that, it can only serve to benefit the sector.
Okay, so I'm going to put you, I love putting my guest on the spot, but this is like a total, this is a total compliment and a nod and a reminder that you and I are going to be working together at, in Ottawa on this event, man. But okay, so what is it about Canadians? Listen to this comment that I just recently shared with somebody. So I'm on social media and I'm talking about, we're talking about expertise, fundraising expertise in particular. And there's Brock, there is a graciousness and a humility that when I talk to my fundraising experts in Canada, they are just far more less arrogant, I guess you could say, than my friends down here on south of the border. Do you know what I'm saying? What is it about Canadians? Because you and I are going to be in Ottawa together, and I would, if somebody knocked on my door right now and said, you know, give me a fundraising expert, I don't care if they're in Orlando or Los Angeles, I would far be quicker to recommend to them somebody like Sam or Jack or Dave or Cindy, some of these people, Marianne, some of these people that you know and I know up in between Toronto and Ottawa and other places, than I would some of these Americans. What is it about you folks that just makes you better when it comes to graciousness and humility? Help me understand that.
Oh, I can only speculate. Jeez. And thank you. I guess thanks. Thanks on behalf of Canadians.
Yeah. And I don't even know if you're, I don't even know if your DNA is 100%. I don't even know enough about you to know that you're 100% Canadian, but I'm going to give you credit for it because you live there.
Thanks. Born and raised. I'm from a town called Belleville, a few hours east of here. Now I'm in Toronto. Yeah. Oh, God. First thing that comes to mind is, you know, the market is so much smaller up here. You know, the number of registered charities we have here, the 80,000 and change versus the like 1.2 million you got down there. So maybe competition maybe plays a role in it. You know, there is certainly, we have competition up here between charities, between sectors, agencies bidding against each other. No doubt there's competition, but it feels small.
Yeah.
It isn't small, but maybe it feels small to us.
Yeah,
maybe Americans saying we're small on a regular basis. I just saw a thread online about someone, this YouTube video. I think it was a YouTube video saying the case for why the Raptors are going to be the last small market team to ever win an NBA championship, and the uproar in the comments section. And my first thought is, small? What are you talking about? Like, we're the sixth largest. Toronto is the sixth largest city in North America. We're just shy of Chicago. You know, Boston's got a fraction, got Oklahoma City in there. The list goes on, but there's this perception of being small that maybe we internalize, oh, we're very small, therefore we better play really nice together.
Yeah.
Jeez. That's a hypothesis right off the top of my head. So.
Yeah, I'm not buying. Like, you're right. I don't think it's a small, because in the fundraising space, one of the things we also know about fundraising is, I think you guys have I think Toronto has the largest AFP chapter on the planet. So in terms of size, you're not fitting the small, you don't fit the small role. So there has to be, I guess what I'm asking you, Brock, is what's in your DNA, or what did mom and dad teach you when you were like 6 years old that my mom and dad didn't teach me, that perhaps just makes you folks a little bit more palatable and more fun to spend time with? Because, I mean, the fact that we're doing this conference up in Ottawa here in a couple of weeks, and I don't get to actually go up there and spend time with these people, is breaking my heart, because I was really looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah, you'll come back. You'll come back. Okay. How about trying to, rather than trying to toot my own horn?
Don't toot your own horn. Just tell me what's in the DNA. Just tell me what it is.
Okay. First thing, one thing comes to mind is I think of the people who were at the forefront of this profession that I know of as being at the forefront of this profession.
Yeah.
30 years ago, Ken Wyman ran and founded this
program
I took at Humber.
Yeah.
Great guy. And so when he's generous and active to this day, and I think he will be, he'll be right to the end. He's never going to stop. And so, so imagine someone like that right at the start, when before AFP was AFP and it was NSFRE, Mike Johnson runs an agency called HJC. He was right at the forefront of digital, working with anyone who was able and willing to test out that space. Yeah. I have a mentor named David Love, who is, if you know, the Agents of Good up here, John Lepp and Jen Love. It's Jen Love's dad. He's been fundraising for 50 years, and he's got a book coming out. I'm sorry, David, if you're listening, the name has slipped my mind, but he's got a book that has either just come out or is coming out about reflection on 50 years. And you couldn't meet a more generous guy. So those are two people who jump to mind. But to go back to stop tuning my own horn and Canadians' own horn is, I don't think it's different in the States. I got looped into a Twitter thread the other day.
Yeah.
Somebody asked me, Ken, coincidentally, somebody asked Ken, when was the first online donation? Ken said, I don't know, but you should ask Brock. So I got tagged into it. So I pulled out, it's packed away now, a book called Fundraising on the Internet, 1996, published by Mal Warwick. And I looked at some of the screenshots in there, and you see names like Beth Cantor tagged in there.
Yeah.
And she's still doing it. She hasn't taken her foot off the gas. And then I saw an article in there, a reprinted chapter with permission by a woman writer consultant named Robin Zeff in the book. It's Robin Zeff Warner, no relation. And I found her on Twitter. I looked her up, where's she? Cause she even predated this book, and she's still doing her thing. She's trying to flip the Senate, or she was trying to flip the Senate, and her name's like Robin Masks Up.
Warner. Sure.
And I just thought, I'm with my people. I like this. So she's down in Virginia, I believe. They're out there. So maybe we do owe credit to some of the founders, quote unquote,
who helped
professionalize this.
Is some of it, because I know that, so I was raised in the church, the evangelical church that is honestly in complete crisis mode right now. And my wife and I have basically completely parted ways for the most part with the evangelical church of our upbringing and retreated to more of your, it doesn't matter, small parishes, a small parish here. But maybe it gets back to your idea of sort of castle building. Maybe part of the problem that we have in our space is no different than anywhere else. In that, because some of the people that you're describing, I would not say have tried to build castles for themselves. They've tried to perhaps be a part of a kingdom, but they haven't necessarily tried to build a damn castle. And I think that's what Tim's is talking about. And when I think about the books that are literally over my head here, I think part of what is sort of evolving in our space now is we're becoming this more generous and distributed economy, and people are not going to be building these major corporations anymore. When I think of Mal, I haven't been in a conference where Mal Warwick was speaking in like 20 years, but I think he's got like a small office in Berkeley or something. And I can't imagine, I mean, he's been terribly influential in the fundraising space, but I don't know that he ever wanted anything other than just to perhaps write those books, be influential in the space and maintain his office in Berkeley. It wasn't to create this sort of a castle, right? Is that kind of what we're getting at? And honestly, I don't want a castle either. I like sitting in my bedroom, sitting behind my laptop. It looks like you're particularly content right now. As long as I pay off my mortgage a little early, I will be perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. Castles just don't interest us. And that's really the same critique. That's really the same critique that in some ways Hyman's has got in his book and Tim's. Hyman's and Tim's have got in their book. And that's really the same critique that we're seeing in the church. And perhaps that's the same critique that's being leveled at the U.S. and some of us pricks here in the Western side of the world that have just spent all of our time building castles.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. You used the word distribution a moment ago.
Yeah.
That is, I think, a good word for what a lot of us are trying to do. We're trying to distribute knowledge. We're trying to, do our jobs, pay our mortgages, take care of our families. And if we can distribute knowledge along the way, that is such a fulfilling value add. There's a quote. This is one of the, I wrote this down so I wouldn't mess it up, is William Gibson, who's a sci-fi author, American, born in America. I think he lives out Western Canada now, but he said the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. He said that a long time ago, but it is I feel like it couldn't be more true. And
yeah,
how I interpret that is these new tools, the latest donation processing tools, the future of online fundraising, it's already here. It just hasn't been distributed evenly yet. And the pandemic really, I think, pushed us quite a ways in the right direction. Canada Helps is a nonprofit donation processing company up here that probably at least a third of all registered charities are using it to some degree. They saw a massive spike in fundraising and so many new charities signing up to use their tool. These are charities who were the most resistant. We're never going to raise money online. What is put in the basket is what we live off of. And not anymore. It's been moved along. So a lot of organizations got pushed a little further into the future, and we have to take that as an opportunity to welcome them into this kingdom that we just built. There's so much fun work there.
Is there, if you sort of just gel all of our conversation together, any critique that we might have with our friends over at Charity Water and all this, we talked about Tim's book and everything, and we talk about digital fundraising. When I started in the, let's go back, 25 years ago, I'm at my first conference, Mal Warwick is speaking, I'm running into direct mail, it was like direct mail is the one best way. It's the only way to get fundraising done. And that those conversations were generally being driven by people that I would characterize, and perhaps you would as well, as castle builders. They were building castles. They were part of large machines that were very characteristic of our economy, that has been our economy for 100 years. But you're part of perhaps part of this new generation of, as I like to think that I am, you're part of this group who's sort of championing digital fundraising, and you're understanding that it's going to be a distributed sort of thing, and nobody's really going to be able to get away with building too many castles. The network effect doesn't let many castles get built. And so therefore the game has sort of changed, and some of those direct mail types that I interacted with literally 20 years ago, I stopped arguing with them about 10 years ago, but some of those direct mail types 25 years ago, they just can't even really thrive and exist anymore because the castles don't work, because the whole method, if you think about the notion of multi-channel, Brock, I think you're a little bit younger than I am, but we didn't talk about multi-channel fundraising 25 years ago because multi-channel fundraising would have undermined or dismissed essentially the superiority of direct mail. Multi-channel fundraising is a nod to the fact that, yeah, there are multi-channels. Yeah, there is a distributed approach. Yeah, there are multiple ways to get to the same sort of goal.
Yeah. These direct mail castles I'll start there. I haven't met Mal.
I don't know enough of his business to in any way suggest that he built a castle. He's not one of the I'm not in any way suggesting Mal built a castle.
Okay. Let's say the large direct mail agencies, more so in the States, just by economy of scale, they're much bigger, yeah, but it applies to Canada too on a smaller scale. These large direct mail agencies, I think what they knew early on is, you can stand up in front of a crowd and tell them this is how you do a direct mail package. And at the end of the day, the audience is not going to go do it themselves. Like they're going to say, oh, they know what they're doing. That person just shared some, they just dropped a knowledge bomb on me. Clearly they know what they're doing. I'm going to hire that person to do it for me now. I don't think a lot of charities took full on direct mail programs in house because they learned how the production timelines are managed and the players. Those agencies, I think as they tried to find opportunities to grow their digital expertise, I've seen a lot that they've added brilliant digital experts and new business professionals who can drive that business.
Yeah.
But I've seen varying levels of success with how they modified their internal, the way they run the business and the way they profit, make a profit,
yeah,
to be able to pay those staff, because it doesn't translate really well. The ways in which you made money off direct mail looked often like markups and campaign management fees. And now digital, it's harder to mark up. Like how you were marking up pieces of paper before, 1% times how many millions of pieces of paper, 1 cent times however many millions of paper is, it adds up, does well. You can pay your bills, you can pay your rent, keep your lease going. It's harder with direct mail. It's harder to pay, you know, 1 cent per email deployment, especially when you see more and more of these third-party tools, your MailChimps, your SendFoxes, these, the HubSpots, who are giving away their product at a base level for free. Like a HubSpot as a marketing tool is incredibly powerful. So the agencies that have done well is they've pivoted and really tried to lean harder into the strategy and the content strategy, the value proposition design, the targeting, the timing, and like very iterative processes of learning. Like how do we not just plant that first tree, which would be the equivalent of like, let's do a big splash in the water campaign. That's planting an apple tree. It's how do we plant that tree? And then how do we harvest the fruit? And then how do we replicate and have an orchard at the end of this, which is challenging. It takes a very different time horizon understanding of success. That we might think that social media can and should be measured on very short time horizons. How do we do this today, within this week, within this month? But in fact, the more that a charity can integrate longer term thinking into their planning around content and campaigns and strategy, the more exponential that return is going to be over time. So why not think about it over 1 year, 5 year, 10 year time spans? What are we going to do with all these people when we build this community? How are we going to harness that energy, and how are we going to harness it for good? And how are we going to make sure that it continues to grow? And how might it become self-sustaining? What's next?
Yeah, and that's what the Hegel guy out in the Silicon Valley is talking about. He's talking about sort of an institutional innovation, which is what you're talking about—the way that we've sort of. We've hired the right digital people, and the digital people come in with the right understanding and posture that they want to fit in the world. But if you don't fundamentally sort of reinvent and innovate with the underlying infrastructure for which you exist, the corporation, and I think that's what Henry Timms talks about in his book, and he's drawing from a lot of other sources as well, is that if the corporation, you know, I don't know if you, Brock, but I have no interest myself when I think about what I aspire to do over the next 20 years. I have no desire whatsoever to build what is considered a traditional corporation. I would love to have extraordinary influence. I won't have no shame about that. But I want to utilize a much more distributed sort of this platform enterprise, which is just a much more distributed sort of posture in the world. And that's kind of enlightening for me to sort of keep myself in check as I listen to what you're saying, Brock, because I sort of alluded to earlier, I have sort of projected onto my digital fundraising friends a lot of the same animosity that I had towards my direct mail friends 25 years ago. So maybe it's fair to say, because the nature of the system that you all have learned to operate in is very different than the nature of the system that the direct mail folks have operated in, you actually come to the table in a very different posture. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, in my early days of fundraising, there was the direct mail agency, but then at War Child Canada, I started right at the bottom, started as an officer. Yeah. And worked my way up to a senior level before I moved on to a new role. But I wrote the grants. I migrated the database. I consolidated the payment systems. I did it all. I did it all. And I learned the hard way, or the firsthand, I should say. I learned firsthand that your online activities, these digital activities, they can be a fantastic pool for major donor prospects. If you're doing great digital communications, you're stewarding your government and your foundation prospects, whether you want to accept that fact or not. Those government funders, they're probably following you. Like the individual, maybe like the grant officers within the larger foundation, they're following you. They're watching. Just know that, just take advantage of that, because these siloed systems of communication, they don't exist anymore. One feeds the other, and all boats can rise if you just start breaking down some of those silos and work together, because it's all for the same purpose in the end.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying, her name's Kathleen
Dr. Kathleen Allen. I don't know where in the world she fits, but she's talking about the book I'm reading is talking about the interdependency in all these systems. That if you want to create a thriving system, if you have to recognize the interdependency and what sort of emerges between the interactions, not so much the, you know, the individual parts. And I think we've for so long focused on the donor or focused on the fundraiser or focused on the person in, you know, your seat or mine or whatever. And it's really the interdependency in the relationship. You know, you and I sit here in this digital space and it's the, we had no idea where this was going to go, but something emerges from it. And that's what fundraising really is you put two people in a room and they interact in a meaningful way. And hopefully you get a very generous gift through it, but you have to trust that sort of unpredictable emergence that sort of happens in the midst of it.
Yeah. I haven't read her book. Wasn't familiar with her. I'm going to check. I'm going to look into it, but from what you just described, the friction between layers, I mean, let's assume they're horizontal layers and maybe not vertical layers. The friction is, you know, that's where the sparks happen. You know, that's where we could really, something really exciting, something new can come out of there. So rather than taking those sparks as signs of danger, let's take them as a, you know, we're going to spark something incredible. That's where there might be something truly emergent and new when you're feeling that. That's when you're blowing on the animal, twisty animal balloon, and it's just not quite going, but just stick to it. And you'll have a little puppy dog in no time.
Brock, we lose our listeners at about 45, 50 minutes, and that's right where we're at. I've enjoyed throwing all sorts of curveballs at you, and you've kept up with me just fine. That's where these podcasts work. You've been a delightful guest. You're always welcome back. Would you mind? I think you've got it open. I want to make sure that we get all the specifics because I don't have my webpage open, but can you remind everyone about the dates and times and specifics of this event that you and I are going to both be at here in a couple of weeks?
Yeah. It's the AFP Ottawa Fundraising Day. It's happening May 5th and 6th. It's a fully virtual conference. The early bird date will have well passed, I suspect. You said we're going to...
I'll broadcast this next week.
Let's assume the early bird date is passed. Tickets are, I believe, about $90 Canadian. Because it's virtual, that might all work in the favor of your American listeners as well. And it's one of the largest. Toronto is the largest chapter in Canada. AFP Ottawa also puts on fantastic conferences. And I know for a fact they've attracted some really great talent this year, given that it's fully virtual. So just head over to afpottawa.ca. The link will be right there in the header. And I think there's going to be two really solid days of fundraising content there.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And for my listeners, we're going to have, just like we've had Brock on here, we're going to have several of the other, I know I've got Simon coming up next week, and a couple other folks are going to be on here that are headlining at the Ottawa conference. Brock, it has certainly been a pleasure. You are always welcome back. Thanks for being my guest today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.